Hi, Emily.
Hi.
I'm Sarah Posner. I'm religion, senior editor at Religion Dispatches, and I'm here today with Emily Bells. She covers politics for World Magazine. World is an evangelical magazine, and Emily and the other political reporters there do, I think, a really interesting, good job of covering politics from a conservative evangelical perspective. So we're going to talk today about what else, the contraception mandate and Rick Santorum's search. For lack of a better word for that phenomenon. So let's start with Beryl Issa's hearing. I think that for a lot of people, they looked at it and thought, what is he doing exactly here? Because this doesn't seem like it would be a really potent issue to most voters. What do you think was at work there? And do you think that it's something that plays well with the Republican base?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was essentially a protest hearing, I think. You know, there's legislation moving in both the House and Senate to address the contraceptive mandate. And I think, you know, the House is obviously a given because it's held by the Republicans that they would support that. So the idea of having a hearing about this issue in the House, you know, is not necessarily can we get this legislation passed, but can we get this issue before the public? So I think that there are a number of reasons that they brought this up. And I mean, I think that religious voters do care about this issue. Mm-hmm. And I think they would characterize it as a religious freedom issue rather than, you know, are we going to make it harder for women to get contraceptives and characterizing it as a women's health issue, which is what Democrats have tried to do. And, you know, I think the kind of political wisdom is that this is not an issue that's a winning political issue. But I think, you know, most voters in the United States are religious. And so it's going to be a question of how this narrative is shaped, you know, if it's a religious freedom issue or if it's a women's health issue.
So, you know, you bring up the point about religious voters, and I think there's been sort of a slew of polling data since Obama announced the regulation on January 20th, and then again since the accommodation that he made earlier this month. I'm now not remembering the exact date, February, a couple Fridays ago in February.
Yeah.
And I think that most of the pollsters have focused on, well, where does this place Obama with Catholic voters? Because Catholic voters are seen as kind of the ultimate swing voters, mm-hmm. and because it was the Catholic bishops who initially objected to the regulation, I think all of the polling focused on, well, does this hurt Obama with Catholic voters? And a lot of the polling has shown that it hasn't. But I think what all the pollsters overlooked, except for Pew, was how does this play with other kinds of religious voters? Mm-hmm. And what was fascinating to me about the Pew data that came out last week, I don't know if you saw this, but they broke it down. All the other polling was, are you Catholic or not Catholic? And the Pew data was, are you Catholic? Are you evangelical? Are you mainline Protestant? Are you Jewish? And the Pew data showed that evangelicals were more opposed to the regulation than Catholics were, and even more so than weekly mass attending Catholics, which is sort of the measure of, you know, devoutness. Hmm. Whether you like that measure or not, that's what the measure is.
Yeah.
And so I just thought that was fascinating and something that perhaps the conventional wisdom is overlooking of how much do you think that this is a motivator for a base that's probably not going to vote for Obama anyway, but may factor into their enthusiasm.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, the Bishop William Laurie, who does the religious freedom issue for the U.S. Catholic Church, he's kind of the point man. He made the point in the hearing that, you know, even though a minority of Americans and a minority of Catholics even oppose the use of contraceptives, even because of that, that doesn't give the government the right to trample on that minority belief. And I think that's a belief that's held by Protestants as well. I think they're pretty strongly motivated on this because a lot of prominent evangelical organizations and leaders have been really vocal on this issue and in shaping it as a religious freedom issue. I mean, everyone from World Relief to the National Association of Evangelicals to Prison Fellowship. I mean, there's a huge spectrum of organizations that have been really vocal about this. So I don't think it is just a Catholic issue. I think evangelicals are pretty strongly vocal on this.
Even though there's no evangelical equivalent of the Vatican, which has any kind of teaching on the use of contraception.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, actually the two FDA drugs that evangelicals consider abortive fashions are also included in this mandate, and that's Plan B and Ella. And that's been that's becoming more of a rallying point on this mandate is that those two drugs are included in it. So I think that's something that Protestants have voiced concerns about. There was a
that came up at the hearing too, the second panel that mm-hmm. had the doctor from Calvin College, Laura Champion was her name.
Yeah.
I think, and she talked about that, but you know, there we have this conflict between, you know, so the evangelical and other and Catholic proponents of this view that Ella and Plan B are abortive patients are going head to head with the classification by the FDA as these drugs as emergency contraception, and they're not classified by the FDA as abortive patients, and they're and so it's almost like this clash of it isn't almost it is a clash between theology and science or theology and medicine, where you have on the one hand this view of when life begins, which is a theological view, and then a different than the science taking a different position that leads to the FDA classification as a contraceptive, not an abortive patient. And this, to me, I think you're right to bring this up in the sense that this is an issue. I think it's going to become more of an issue. But, you know, I think that the FDA classification is dispositive of it, even though there's this religious view that these drugs may or do act as an abortive patient.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty mainstream pro-life view or widely held pro-life view that life begins, you know, at conception. And so when these drugs prevent an embryo from attaching to the side of the womb, that, you know, pro-life, most pro-life people would say that, you know, that's ending a life. So that's, I would say that's probably the thought behind that.
Right. But I thought that even the science on that, that Plan B does not do that. Plan B is basically a mega dose of the same hormone that's in birth control pills. And that Ella, it's not known whether it actually does that, or it may, if it does do it, it's in a small number of cases. So, and I think also that the another issue that I heard brought up from this perspective was, or another question I heard brought up from this perspective was the IUD too, the coverage of the IUD.
Yeah.
So the same, basically the same rationale there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think, you know, the main point that they would make is that these are, you know, each denomination has different positions on, and different religions have different position on all these different forms of contraception. And I guess the general point that all these different religious leaders from different spectrums would make is that they want to be able to make these decisions and not be forced to buy these things by the government.
Do you think that the argument that it's the government making you do something is possibly more potent than the infringement on religious belief? I mean, you know, do you think that it's kind of like a way of appealing simultaneously to a Tea Partier who might be more focused on the government making you do something, regulating something, and a more sort of religiously motivated voter who may be more focused on the argument being made by the bishops?
Yeah, that's a good thought. I mean, I think there are probably strains of that, but I think, I mean, kind of zooming back a little bit, I think the religious leaders see this as a church issue, as a religious issue, and not as a political issue. And I think they hate the fact that that this has become a partisan issue. They want to protect their sphere, you know, and not be they don't want to be in the political sphere. I mean, I'm just speaking as, you know, people that I've interviewed, church leaders that I've interviewed about this. I think that they would like to, you know, not have to be in this fight right now. But the point is that they want their autonomy from the state. And they see that as a critical right that they have to protect to keep those boundaries. And I think that's the primary motivator, not a political motivation about, you know, government having too much power or something like that.
But have you talked with anybody who, so there are 28 states that have a sort of similar law to the HHS regulation. Have you talked to anybody about how they have worked within those state laws? Because, you know, the Catholic Charities challenged those state laws in two states, in California and New York, and lost. So they've had to adjust, so to speak, to having a very similar kind of requirement at the state level.
Yeah, it's that's something I'd like to do more reporting on, because I think it could prove really interesting, because I think each state is different and they have different sets of exemptions for different groups. I mean, part of the problem with this is that in the real world of religious organizations, there's so many different types of insurance. I mean, there's, you know, Christian medical sharing where people pay for each other's medical bills.
Right. And they have an exemption from the entire individual mandate in the healthcare law.
Yeah. And then, but, you know, I've talked to some of those groups and actually they found that they're under the employer mandate. So, you know, their clients are exempt.
So the healthcare sharing ministry itself
has
to provide insurance to their employees.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a very complicated world when you're trying to address all these different types of insurances. So, you know, the other thing is at the state level I mean, from my understanding, you cannot offer insurance and you wouldn't be under the same penalties that you would be at the federal level. So I think there's a lot of different things going on at the state level. And I think that's one area that hasn't been reported on very extensively, and so I hope to do more on that.
Well, we were talking about how this is not just about Catholics, and I wanted to jump off of Mike Huckabee's comment at CPAC a week before last, that, you know, in reference to this specific thing, he said, we're all Catholics now. And, you know, so here we have a Southern Baptist minister saying, we're all Catholics now. It's a fascinating moment for anyone who covers religion and politics, because I think that people have the sort of stereotypical view that there's this conflict between Catholicism and Southern Baptist, for example, you know, theological conflict, right? And now, you know, we had a campaign, a GOP primary campaign that started with, you know, with the succession of frontrunners. The succession of frontrunners started with two evangelical frontrunners, Michelle Bachmann and then Rick Perry. And now, towards the end, we think, of the process, we are seeing two Catholic frontrunners, first Newt Gingrich and then now Rick Santorum.
It's an amazing thing.
So, go ahead.
Well, just especially if you think back, you know, 40 years, you know, having a Catholic and a Mormon as frontrunners for the presidency would have been unthinkable.
Unheard of, right.
So,
right.
Yeah, this is amazing.
So what do you think that says about the conservative movement and where it's going, or how it's evolved with this religious base? Because it's not like Catholics were not involved in the conservative movement or the rise of the religious right. You know, you had early people like Paul Ryrick who were Catholic. And so it's not, that piece isn't unheard of. It's just that we haven't seen presidential candidates, I think, except for Rudy Giuliani, who were Catholic.
Yeah, I think this specific issue on contraceptives is just one in a number of issues where Catholics and Protestants have joined together on religious liberty stuff. You go back a couple of years, a bunch of these leaders came out together with a Manhattan Declaration, and that was a statement on, you know, protecting unborn life and then traditional marriage and religious liberty at different levels. And so from there, you know, there have been issues regarding, you know, for example, the Hosanna Tabor case that brought together a lot of Protestants and evangelicals.
That was the ministerial exception case that was just decided by the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, so I feel like the Manhattan Declaration laid the groundwork basically for what's happening today. So the Manhattan Declaration came out in 2009. It was drafted primarily, my understanding, by Robbie George, who's a Catholic and an academic. And the evangelical Beeson, yeah, Timothy Beeson, is that the person who drafted it with George? But I felt like it laid out this idea that abortion rights and same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption and all of these different advances for the rights of different people in society was placed in conflict with the religious freedom of the people who drafted the Manhattan Declaration. And in that document, they basically said, you know, they basically vowed to engage in civil disobedience if they were, in their view, compelled to have to comply with the law on, on these sorts of issues. I mean, do you think that it was that they were anticipating different things, or just they were basing that on things that had already happened, same-sex marriage laws, for example, do you think that that laid the groundwork for how this is playing out, this contraception issue is playing out now?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I actually hadn't thought about that as kind of the groundwork for what's happening now, but I think it's probably it's a good idea. It's a valid theory. I think, you know, all those people who were behind the Manhattan Declaration, Robbie George and Chuck Colson and all the rest, they are people who are very plugged into their religious communities, and they're also plugged into the culture. So I think they saw a lot of these trends happening. And, you know, I would add that in that declaration, they also mentioned that, you know, the church hasn't done a very good job of promoting, you know, solid ideas of marriage and that sort of thing. So it was self-critical as much as it was, you know, against the wider culture at large.
And do you think that that's playing a role here in the way the contraception debate is playing out, in the sense that part of their goal is to educate or possibly to motivate changes, those cultural changes, maybe as compared to political changes? But this is not just about stopping this regulation or even about the 2012 election, but it's about kind of a longer game of changing people's minds about these issues.
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, I was sitting in that committee hearing and I was realizing, you know, in the few years that I've covered the Hill, I don't think we've ever had a conversation like this that's been so widely covered about these religious freedom issues and about, you know, kind of the broader principle behind the thing. So I think church leaders do see this as an opportunity where they have to stand firm on their principles. And that's why You saw a lot of opposition to the accommodation that President Obama announced on February 10th, and I think they say we have to really make our point, and it's not just for like you said, 2012. This is an issue about educating our parishioners, and you know the Catholic Church actually is just issuing curriculum to all its churches on religious freedom right now. So I think they
curriculum for the schools or for the priests to use in mass.
I think it's for the priests to use in mass.
Uh-huh.
This is something they announced at their meeting, I guess, a month or two ago. So I think they see this as a huge education opportunity.
Well, let's talk about Santorum a little bit, because something that's come up with him. So yesterday on the campaign trail, he talked about Obama having the government that's oppressive and controlling, and we need to defend the foundational institutions of the church. This was him speaking in a Southern Baptist church in Georgia yesterday. And then he was talking about Obama, President Obama, believing in some phony ideals, some phony theology. And he later said that what he meant there was that the theology was the theology of environmentalism and that he wasn't questioning President Obama's faith or his Christianity. And then in mixed in with all of this that Santorum is talking about on the campaign trail, there was this speech that he gave at Ave Maria College or University back in 2008, where he's talking about this being not a political war, this is not a cultural war, it's a spiritual war. And he talks about Satan having set his sights not just on the culture in general or the country in general, but on the church in particular. And he talks, and I think that the one quote, it's a fairly long excerpt from the speech, but the one quote that really has gotten some play was that if we look at the shape of mainline Protestantism in this country, and it is in shambles, it is gone from the world of Christianity as I see it. So they attacked, and I think he's talking about academia here, they attacked mainline Protestantism, they attacked the church. And what better way to go after smart people who also believe they're pious, use both vanity and pride to go after the church. And so what do you make of that quote? I mean, I think a lot of people interpret it as that he was saying that mainline Protestantism is satanic, but it's not that clear to me that's exactly what he was saying. How would you interpret it?
Yeah, I think a lot of Rick Santorum, the controversy that surrounds him sometimes is because of these sound bites. And yeah, if you look at the wider context, you start to understand what he's saying. But I think, he's a devout Catholic, and the criticism of the mainline Protestant denominations is probably something that would be shared by a lot of evangelicals and Catholics alike. Mainline Protestants have been a declining population for the last 50 years, and it's a minority of Protestants now. And I think I don't know what exactly the point is he was trying to make, but I would say that you look at divisions that are happening at the church level, and you'll see that this is something that would probably hit home with a lot of devoutly religious people. In terms of the divisions that are happening in the Episcopal Church and the Presbyterian Church of the USA. So
this is over gay marriage and gay ordination, and even I think in some cases ordination of women.
Yeah, that's part of the issue, but I would say also, there are a number of theological issues regarding, whether Jesus is the only way of salvation and that sort of thing that mm-hmm. are why a lot of Anglican denominations have formed in the U.S. and split from the Episcopal Church.
Right, right. Well, so mainline Protestants still comprise something like 20% of the U.S. population, is that right?
That sounds right. I'm not positive,
yeah.
But...
And,
or 20% of Protestants, I think is...
So the rest of the Protestants would be evangelicals and
right.
evangelicals or, and so you wouldn't include say Southern Baptists in, you would put those in the evangelical camp. So we're talking
right.
Episcopalian,
mm-hmm.
UCC, et cetera. Well, I mean,
yeah.
I think that the, I think that's something that strikes a lot of people, outside the evangelical or the very devout Catholic world is when a politician starts talking about spiritual warfare.
Mm.
And I think that people, there's sort of an incredulity, I think, that happens when a politician starts talking about that, because what I think people hear is he talking about, spiritual war between whom? And who is Satan representing? Is Satan representing liberals? Is Satan representing people whose political beliefs are different from Santorum's?
Mm-hmm.
And, what kind of political, divisive political messaging that is? And I say this as a religion reporter who understands that there are a lot of people in America who see these conflicts as being spiritual conflicts,
mm-hmm.
as being spiritual warfare. But I still, and I understand that that's how a lot of people see it, but I still think that it's a divisive political rhetoric. That said, Santorum wasn't running for anything when he gave the speech at Ave Maria, but anyway.
Yeah.
So, but what do you, I mean, how do you explain spiritual warfare to somebody who doesn't view the world that way?
Yeah, I think there's a good distinction to be made in that the rhetoric is perhaps different from, I mean, he'll have to defend his own rhetoric, but when it comes to, you know, votes that he's taken, I don't think anyone would, if you look back at his time in the Senate and in the House, he was never using, that I know of, he was not using this kind of rhetoric, and he was voting to represent his constituency.
Right, when you say this kind of rhetoric, you're saying the spiritual warfare rhetoric.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think if he's speaking, you know, if he's speaking in a church context, I can see how that would be a different sort of thing than, you know, if he's using that rhetoric on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I do,
Even on the campaign trail.
Or that, yeah. So he'll have to explain, I think, to people what he means and be clear about it and not, but I do think that one point to make is that a lot of Americans are more use more religious language in their everyday speech than most people do in the urban centers of D.C. where I live, and New York and places like that. So I think it's much more common language to talk about religion in everyday speech in most parts of America than it is maybe on cable TV.
I think that's probably true. But I also think that there's the lines that we still haven't figured out how to draw in mm-hmm. political campaigns of when this is crosses a line where a candidate is favoring a certain religious view, because then you have the problem of that the bishops are talking about, actually, that, you know, one view is being favored over to the detriment of their religious view.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is an issue that is going to continue to come up because, you know, because I think Santorum, and I don't think Romney does it so much, but I mean, I think as long as this GOP primary is playing out, Santorum, for example, the language he used yesterday about Obama's phony theology, and then he said it was about environmentalism, but still, and that he wasn't questioning Obama's faith, but still, mm-hmm. you have this text from the speech at Ave Maria where he was talking about mainline Protestantism being in decline and being in a shambles, and, well, you know, President Obama is a mainline Protestant. He went to a UCC church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that Santorum is going, if he's saying that he's not questioning Obama's faith, he's very much questioning the spiritual ideas around Obama's policy and questioning Obama's religious tradition too.
Yeah. I think, you know, like I said, the rhetoric is something he's going to have to be clear about and be clear about what he means. But I think that each of the candidates is coming from a religious perspective. And, you know, there have been questions about, well, is, you know, Mormonism has these different beliefs. So how is this going to affect Romney if he becomes president? And what's he going to do in his policies that will, you know, come from his Mormon worldview? And so I think those are legitimate questions. And mm-hmm. it's legitimate to ask, you know, can this person govern in a pluralistic society? Mm-hmm. And the safe thing as a candidate is to, you know, just stick to the platitudes about right. their faith, which is what Romney and Obama have both done. So we'll see if, you know, Santorum being a little more edgy, I guess you could say.
yeah, a little bit.
how that'll, you know, I think there's a huge effort to define Santorum right now. So it'll be a big battle over the next few days and weeks.
He's definitely under the microscope. And, you know, he's beating, according to the polls, Romney in his home state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Quinnipiac poll from Ohio, which showed him way ahead of the other candidates among Ohio's evangelicals.
Mm.
Does that surprise you?
It does. I think he could be even further ahead if Gingrich dropped out.
Oh, you think so? And so,
yeah.
So this is, again, this sort of shared worldview, if you will. Even though I think that people have a stereotype of an antipathy between evangelicals and Catholics, this mm-hmm. is not the case anymore. There's a shared political agenda that causes, you know, sort of an erasure of any theological differences between evangelicals and Catholics. Do you think that's fair? I mean, I think that's what the Manhattan Declaration people were trying to argue.
Yeah. I think that's a good insight. I mean, I think a lot of these issues have united those two different camps, and it's pretty wild as somebody who's kind of on the sidelines observing to just see all this happen in such a short amount of time, you know,
mm-hmm.
just the last couple of years, really, to see this coalesce in such a way.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see the outcome of the primaries this Tuesday, and then on Super Tuesday, it'll be really interesting.
Yeah, it continues to be a wild ride.
Yes. Well, listen, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Hey, it was great to talk to you.
Same. All right, take care.
All right, bye.